So Claire's here. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm very good. And one very exciting thing is Claire brought a team with her to review a project and to come up with some ideas for Chinatown, actually, which we'll get to right after this interview. And we'll turn on the room mics and we'll actually have a mini, like, charrette.
Great.
Almost, I guess.
We can talk Chinatown.
That's awesome.
Night markets.
That's amazing.
And Allen Street.
So Claire Weiss, founder and partner at WXY. And now with three other partners, is that right?
Yeah, three and associates and directors. But my partners are Mark Yos, who's the Y in WXY, Adam Lubinsky, and Lang Pugh.
Amazing. And how long has WXY been, when did you guys form?
Well, a long time ago, but I get to be the oldest partner. So 1998, about.
Okay.
Mark was working for Pay Partnership. I founded it. We had one employee, Usman Haque. I think that was 99. And then 9/11 hit, and that kind of changed things in terms of just like, it was a bit of a wake-up call about what kind of practice we should have. And so from there, it kind of, in 2006, we started really concentrating on doing work. It didn't matter, like, if it was a building, if it was not a building, that was super local. Like, we were really like, okay, we should be able to walk to our projects and or take the subway. And so I think that kind of changed the trajectory. And in 2006, we became W times Y because we added a partner, Lang. And then after that, actually in 2012, Adam joined. And now the W, people say WXY,
yeah, it's,
but it's really W times Y. Really is, Adam's a planner.
Okay.
So we kind of started to really evolve the policy and planning side to support design. So to try and have design and planners and designers, if they already didn't have two hats to be in dialogue with each other.
And so now you guys, I just spoke to, I forgot her name.
Pylene. Or Simone.
That one, the one waving.
Yeah, Pylene.
Pylene. You are around 50 people now? I mean, you guys are
Yeah, I say 46, but I guess we're 50. So 50, we're about 46 full-time. And then we're lucky enough to have interns come from both planning and architecture schools for like 6 and 8 month internships.
Okay.
So there's about 4 or 5 people are doing interns.
Are all 46 to 50 here in New York?
Everyone's in New York.
Yeah,
in New York, except that our director of civic impact, Tracy Sanders, has just started a WXY in Chicago.
Even you said WXY.
Yeah, I know. I say WXY because it's easier. Although some people say XYZ, which is apparently even easier.
Just add. Just
so,
find that Z part.
Exactly. Well, I figured that last letter of my name is a Z.
Oh, okay. There you go.
So if I gave up the first letter of my name, W,
you could do XYZ.
You could do XYZ.
Or you just have both bookend it.
Exactly. You know, right around the corner from our office, there's a WXY sewing company still. They don't actually sew, but they sell sewing machine supplies.
Were they there before you moved
and
your office?
We realized too late that they had the name before. Although maybe that's a good thing.
There's probably some like cross project. You could probably do some sort of like project together with them.
We should try, although they're never open. I think it might just be a mailing address, and they might actually be in Flushing.
Just a good front.
Just a good front, exactly.
So just to what I'd love to do is kind of work backwards, kind of where you guys are right now. But just before we get into that, can you talk about any of the projects that you're open to talk about and kind of the kind of work you're doing now so people get a sense of what W times Y is up to?
Yeah, I mean... Sure, I'll
Would
do
like
more tea. Look at, I'm drinking tea, and people are hearing about it. I think that we're really still gravitating to like doing work at extreme scales.
Okay.
So, you know, a drinking fountain, they're just finishing up the next set of public cabins. So these are New York State Parks commissioned. We did a prototype of a public cabin.
No way.
Which is different than what you can pull off as a individual going to your own cabin. Because okay. imagine a cabin that, you know, people show up with huge families or just themselves and a couple, but it has to be totally ADA accessible and yet still feel like a cabin. So the next set's being finished up. I'm excited to go see them.
So there's already public cabins like this.
Yeah, so there's now 20
okay.
at Wildwood State Park,
okay.
which is North Fork. And there's about to be 16 more on the beach at Heckscher Park.
And you've designed all of those?
Yeah, because they're all kind of a kit. Hmm. They're designed so the park rangers can build them.
Amazing.
And so that's like small, right? That's like the smallest one of those is kind of the size, you know, 3/4 of the size of the space.
Okay.
In fact, you know, 34 East Broadway is like a cabin. I'm looking at it, and it's got, for anyone not on the radio, so imagine we're it at a round triangle table at the end of a space that's about 10 to 12 feet wide and about 30 feet long. And that's kind of what these cabins are, except they have a, you know, the bigger ones have like a side pocket, you know, a clip-on. And the very end of it, the first 10 feet would be outdoors because it would be the porch.
Oh, interesting. Why did you make them long and skinny?
You know, at first we thought they were going to have to be delivered on a truck and be prefab. And then they evolved into... And also there's something about really simple rectangles that are cabin-ish. So there's that scale, which is urban-rural, I call it. Like the fact that you're in a city and you really need to get away and what that might mean. And then there's the kind of industry stuff in the middle, which is where do we all work? So the Navy Yard master plan just got released. And I think it's really hopeful because it's basically going back to what, you know, when I first moved to Chinatown, many, many of the buildings were all garment and they were essentially vertical factories. They were, you know, six to nine stories of people working on stuff and making stuff. And that doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, it's sort of stacked doctors and dentists' offices. And in Chinatown more than anything, and very little of anything else except for on the ground floor. Right. But the Navy Yard is the kind of, I think, the city's, and I would say kind of North America's hope for vertical industry again. Mm. That the next generation of makers will want to work with other people, and they'll want to be in an ecosystem, and that they still will need extremes of space, like super tall to small, and it will need city support. But like, if we can build freeways, I don't see why we can't build vertical factories.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's like the middle. And I think the other, and some of that includes, we just, if you guys ever, you should take the ferry. We're just finishing up a kind of public space at Brooklyn Army Terminal.
Oh, wow.
What used to be all parking. Now it's like, you know, ballet of cars, move the cars there, move the trucks there, move the people and ferries over there. So it's a coexistence scheme, and I think there's some fun elements for people working at BAT and for people living in the neighborhood to get to know each other. And then maybe the other thing that's really exciting to think about is really the projects that have just started construction for us, and one of them is the former Spofford Juvenile Jail. Going to be transformed into a live-work place called the Peninsula with a lot of project partners in Hunts Point in the Bronx.
Okay.
And, you know, Hunts Point Peninsula has the New York's fish market. It has the produce market. It has, you know, a real working population, but there's a lot of people who don't earn a lot of money. And there hasn't been any new affordable housing. So this is 100% affordable housing project, but it's also 100% affordable work project. So there's a industrial building we've designed as part of that for food production and maybe some media on the floor. And there's also going to be a theater as part of it.
So do you in your office when you're having all these different scales going on at once and mixtures of programs going on at once, do you, obviously you don't treat every project the same by any means, but do you philosophically approach projects similarly, or are the cabin ones completely separate in terms of where, let's say, WXY brings to the table than the Navy Yards, than the housing that was the jail?
I think our idea is that all projects deserve planning. Hmm. They deserve a kind of a planner's mind, and all projects deserve kind of a design architect's mind. Hmm. And that doesn't matter, because even the cabins required that whole who are they for, that, like, why should they be there versus there, what does it mean? Well, like, what does traditional cabin mean to someone? And sometimes that's hard to do if you're in an architect in your bubble. And I think for planners, too, like you, D15 is our big planning project we just finished, which is very controversial, maybe for some of your audience, too.
Where is that?
It's District 15 in basically Brooklyn. Okay. So it's Park Slope to Sunset Park. And it was about desegregating that district for middle school students. And so it really, the design there was to design a process, you know, to design how do we communicate what's actually happening? How do we get people around a table? How do we get people standing up and telling you what they think? So that in order to come to some new ideas about basically what kids need to have to get in one school versus another, and how the whole district could be a real example for why a diverse and desegregated school system produces way more excited learners and happier teachers.
So with that project specifically, let's say, and even as an architect having a very ignorant sense of what planning entails, obviously you're producing a lot more than, like, I always picture a master plan. But that's actually, in this case, it seems like, are you producing a set of documents? Is it actually a playbook?
Yeah, you're doing a lot of data analysis that then has to be graphically understood. You know, like, I'm trying to remember the author that, like, remember data informatics
and stuff
in school?
Absolutely.
And wondering, ooh, what does that have to do with me? I mean, the truth is, in planning, it has a lot to do with design of information.
Okay. And conveying of information.
But also finding ways to find out if that information is being contradicted by facts on the ground. So that's where the sort of, I think, spatial mind comes into play, because you can plan, you know, as many kids now going to school A versus school B, but what if people can't renovate school A in time versus school B? And I think that's where these perfect algorithms that many cities, let's say like Boston, have adopted, have run into trouble, because in fact sometimes by kind of perfecting a system, that system gets subverted, and just doing something mathematically doesn't actually result in what you think it's going to result in. I always say that it's a little bit like designing a public space based on what's in, you know, what you observe. So you can set up a camera and look at how people, let's see, out here or on Confucius Plaza are moving because of where fences are and stuff now. But it doesn't really tell you how would move if they had different choices.
Sure. Do you find in, obviously, especially with the projects where you're involved from everywhere, from the research, data, information kind of conveyance to the master planning down through the design, do you find that even your own, once you get to the design stage, that your own design is also contradicting things that you had set out in your own planning because you're looking at it differently?
That's a good question. I think it is, but I think the thing that doing design early in a planning process, like, comes from a bias that we have, that form, like making kind of forms can actually either attract or repel certain things, so that actually creating or building something early rather than later kind of teaches you something. And that, you know, people have turned that into pilot projects and stuff. But it's also true of just sitting down and adding design into something that seems to be like a dry verbal process, and just start making a sketch model or saying what if and piling things up kind of changes the conversation. So like I sort of picking up a pencil.
So I love that you brought a design project into the space. I'm really excited to kind of sit with you guys to see how you guys work and actually hear about it and hopefully contribute in some way.
Well, actually, after seeing the Gateway to Chinatown, I mean, I think that it kind of gets to this question about, you know, a lot of the idea of people see planning as contextual instead of seeing that contexts are contradictory and inspiring and actually you can add to the context. And I think that's sort of, we fight that all the time, is this kind of idea that, you know, planning is something that's supposed to match what's already there.
Right, right.
Whereas, you know, and I think that's bringing the architectural sensibility to it.
To actually, it would have, makes an active change, and you're very deliberate about that, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's sort of why it's a different idea to bring design and planning together, is that, you know, the world is full of contradictions, and in a way, sometimes the contradictions need to be played up and understood for people to embrace the possibility of them, instead of sort of kind of just making things match and pretending those contradictions aren't there.
So the work you just described, and that actually even the scope that W times Y is involved with, seems like a dream, frankly. Like, I was like, oh, this is the kind of stuff that certainly I'm sure young designers and myself included would love to. It's like, how do you get to the point where you're able to work at not only those scales and those types of programs, but again, the scope from planning all the way through to architecture and design. And so how did you get here? So one thing I was going to ask was, when you mentioned something about what 9/11 shifted for you guys, the how you saw your work or your office, can you get more into that? What shifted in it?
Well, I think that, and at the time, I was co-executive director of the Design Trust with Annie Woodner, and her project was reclaiming the High Line. And no one thought that it should happen as a project. They thought it was completely futile that we were working on it with Robert and Josh. And what happened is that we staged a conversation in the Port Authority in their conference room between the state and the city, kind of more as like a casual meetup, and with a bunch of experts from, you know, in transportation. And at this event, everyone came, the speakers and the audience came to the conclusion that vision actually needed to lead. And once you had vision and politics together, the money would come, like the finance would come. And that sort of, like, for me was a light bulb moment. And of course, that was August. And
what year?
2001. And literally, this is why I'm on the 9/11.
Right, right.
And literally, you know, 9/11 happened in September. And this remember the competition for the World Trade Center and how interested everyone was? And it was a kind of eureka moment where it was clear that whether politicians or, you know, or people who were doing the usual kind of thing believed it or not, that actually people wanted to change their city. They were interested in what things looked like and acted like, right? And so we kind of looked at ourselves and said, you know, we should actually believe in a vision for the High Line, because that actually is the thing that is hopeful. Like, it's not about, like, no one cares about design. And because we're proving ourselves, we just had incredible, like, kind of catastrophic attack on the city, and it destroyed people's lives and homes, and people's jobs weren't there anymore. And look, people want to imagine the future. That's got to say something. So it felt like there was a kind of sea change. And that I found really personally inspiring. So it made me think that it is possible within kind of practicing as an architect to project a future in a deliberate way in conversation and dialogue with other people. And I think that kind of shifted not only the course of the Highline Project, but the course of why I wanted to practice and where kind of practice went. And I think for that reason, there's a lot of projects that, they took a decade. Mm-hmm. They took a long time in their portfolio, whether it's the Sanitation Garage or Sea Glass Carousel, that were the sort of, are in the category of projecting that if there's something inherent that attracts people as an idea, then it can be about a deeper idea too. It can be about, you know, how amazing it is that we organize as a city and pick up our own garbage, or it can be about how amazing it is that we have a park that's on the edge of a giant ocean. And we live in New York, and some kids have never been in an ocean or learned how to swim. So I think really that's why I refer to 9/11. Whereas when Sandy hit, I saw it as an opportunity because we'd been working on the East River Blueway, and so many, like, bubbling up from the community, like the city projected a Vision 2020, but no one believed it, that actually floods, sea level rise was happening. And the community, you know, Lower East Side Ecology Center and various ecologists and advocates who all joined together to work on the Blue Way, they believed we could do better as a city, that we should kind of plan for climate change. And then when Sandy happened, that report and that project was ready, and it got released like 3 months later, and it was like the first thing out after Sandy. And in a sense, I think it, without having the attitude that architects can join with other scientists, graphic designers, community activists to actually imagine a better future, then, you know, then, but it used to be that wasn't the case. So when I hear you say, hey, Claire, that's a dream, the Mostyns would want it, I go, well, that is amazing. That in itself is more important than anything that you say that, because I would say 20 years, that wasn't what people coming out of architecture schools thought that they could have. So the fact that people know they could have that as an option now is probably more important than anything else.
That's amazing. I do feel like there's, and I'm curious if when you say you're realizing, oh, we can lead with the vision and the rest will come eventually. It may take 10 years, but it'll come. And for example, with the Blue Way project or any of the projects you listed, does that imply basically a tangible design? Like when you say vision, does that mean a tangible design? You're putting something out there that people can be like, oh, that's what it'll look like.
Yeah, I kind of think it means putting stuff out there with other people where they react to it and you respond. So you evolve a design that's responding to something, whether it's to the people who have to take care of it, whether it's to, you know, people on the street that walk in. But it can't be, I think in the sort of historically architects responded to a competition in a, you know, Chicago Tribune Tower or whatever, that in, with beautiful schemes, but they were kind of immaculate, you know, like, here it is, take it or leave it. And that's really true in some other countries still. But I think that that kind of vision I'm talking about that then attracts, you know, politics in the kind of people sense of the word, like us, attracts sort of a general interest and then attracts a kind of the funding needs a kind of design dialogue. So it needs that design. And even as an architect, you put something out, you have to be prepared to respond and respond again. So I don't think it can be just like design scheme one.
I mean, I love that it's also bringing, whether it's architects or planners or designers, as part of the initial kind of release of what this project could be, whether there's a design kind of attached to it or not, as opposed to, and maybe those are alluding to, that kind of assumption that design is the last piece of the puzzle, like which I think typically it almost still sort of is seen as, but I love that you know, is there a way to put that vision or whatever it is much more towards the beginning, so that's part of that conversation, and it actually builds and actually generates excitement because there's skills in there that can be used to communicate certain things to the public that you don't really get until you bring designers in.
I think that's super important. I think that we're kind of nonverbal as architects, but the knowledge and skills are as much about critical thinking as, let's say, planners who are more verbal. And I think architecture and cities has to be there at the beginning to be part of the dialogue. And most commissions or cities assume they work things out and then they bring architects in. And I think that's really makes projects less effective. I mean, it sort of also gives, as an architect, it gives you less to work with. So some of it is how you can put yourself in the position to have more information and have, like, a bigger palette to work with.
So how did you get into doing work that was more on the civic scale to begin with?
I think it was a question, I think, for all of us, right, of kind of seeking opportunity in places maybe that were less known. So some of it was collaborating with engineers to, you know, get brought in on projects where no one thought they needed an architect, but it turned out they did, right? And some of the early projects were really like, it was supposed to be a re-roofing job, but it turned into a you know, park.
Nice.
Or changing, or Astor Place, too. I mean, Astor Place was an infrastructure project where the engineers really are the city of New York, but we got brought in to sort of, you know, only look at one aspect of it, and it turned out we looked at the whole thing, and it's really much more of a kind of where should the curbs go project, and can we, like, kind of reproportion the space and make it kind of seal, you know, basically heal a bunch of wounds from the Second Avenue elevated being removed and no one ever figuring out what to do. So it's like sometimes you end up working on really old problems, like where freeways got put somewhere or removed and no one knows what to do. And so that some of those projects are not, you have to find ways through unorthodox commissions to actually get to those problems.
Right. Can you talk about that? Wasn't fully following when you mentioned when you first, I guess you and Mark first formed WXY.
Yeah.
When it was still called WXY. Was this
It was called Y's plus Y's originally.
Oh, Y's plus
Y's.
And
that's the, how, so that plus got rotated.
Amazing.
By our friends, Jessica Helfand and Bill Drantel. They kind of rebranded us as W times Y.
That X has a whole, like, life of its own.
The X has
there.
A whole, yeah, X marks the spot.
Did you?
You guys, too. Plus pool, X pool. I bet people are always
going,
is
that cross pool all the time?
Right, cross pool. No.
Was that the first practice that you had founded at the time?
No. Early on, I founded with Ursula Warshall, Ulla Warshall, who's now a book artist.
Okay.
Wise plus Warshall. And actually, before that in California, I founded a couple of practices because I did a lot of houses before I moved in L.A. Hain Winkler Wise, I think, was one of them, and just my own name was one of them. Yeah, I'm into, you know, the multiple iterations or many hats.
But I guess it seemed clear that you'd wanted to be part of or start your own practice for a while, I guess, before.
Yeah, and I like the fact that WXY is now less about, you know, kind of the principles and stuff. It's really much more, it's a really interesting group of people. It's constantly evolving, taking on different problems. And I think what I was searching all those years was less of a personality-centered practice, but a kind of content-centered practice.
Do you remember what the very first project, W plus WXY?
Oh, well, the first project was, well, the first project was a visitor center for the Museum of Jewish Heritage. And it's actually probably still in a box somewhere, but it was our first public building, and it had to be designed and built in 6 months for the opening. And it was really this beautiful six-sided wedge, the first metal building built in Battery Park City. Wow. And it was coated copper, and it had all of this symbolism of a Star of David without being a Star of David. So it was like the six-sided thing, and there was a long window, and then it was sort of a gateway portal. But the whole purpose of that building, literally, was to basically scan people so they wouldn't blow up the museum.
Oh, wow.
So, and it was an afterthought that they realized they couldn't scan people in the building. Huh. It's a Kevin Roche building. Uh-huh. So where his second edition, it was there. And so, like, it was our, you know, it was 1,200 square feet and made out of, you know, storefront. Right. But it was, you know, plywood, truss joists. But it was, I still think, one of our best projects.
And it actually got realized? Or
it got built, it was up there. And right after 9/11, when they wanted to build the second part, they dismantled it. And it's being stored in a box somewhere because it was less than 7 years. It was up, and it was built with public funding. So, hey, maybe someone, a not-for-profit, wants it one of these years, and we can unpack it.
Wait, is there a seven-year lifespan?
Yeah, so if you build with public funding, the building has to be up for 7 years in order for you to demolish it. So they couldn't demolish it.
Amazing.
They could take it apart and put it away.
Does the city need to fund its new home if it goes somewhere else?
No. Oh. So that's the problem. Is okay. The city doesn't need to fund its new home, so
it just kind of sits.
Yeah. I don't have no idea where it is. But but I think it's sometimes in New York harder to erect something that it is to demolish something.
Yeah,
or
I can
it could
imagine.
Be vice versa.
Yeah. Do you remember how that project came about?
Yeah, I got a call because we had done, you know, it used to be a thing in Battery Park City, security booths, like funny shaped, interesting security booths. And Battery Park City was one of the first parts of New York that commissioned design. David Emile was the president, and he loved architecture, and to this day, he's like, you know, and so the museum, they had Kevin Roche as their architect, but they thought they were just going to they wanted someone to decorate a trailer. And I got a call. And, you know, we were an office of one, you know, one and a half. Mark was working at Pay Partnership. Mm. And so he was the evening shift, and I was the daytime shift. And Usman was, Hawk was the only employee. Huh. And he's back in London doing amazing things. Right. And we basically said, this would be a pity to just park a trailer there. Huh. We have to convince them that this, you know, a building or a, can do so much more. So this is one of the first times also that we were like, has to be indoor, outdoor, just like, let's just run the asphalt pavers right through it and kind of make a sort of public-private thing. And actually it came together really fast. Right after that, our first house commission kind of looks a little bit like it, and it still exists. And it was sort of based on de Kooning's studio. And we did that in, you know, the far, almost at Montauk, but the sort of far reaches of the Hamptons. And those two projects were kind of our only built projects for a long time.
And then at which point did Mark jump on full time?
You know, basically within a year of that.
Okay.
99.
Okay, great. So can you describe the night market project that we're about to get into?
Oh, great. So Chinatown has some pretty fantastic streets. And it's hard, even in Chinatown, hard kind of for a lot of people to pay rent on various things, whether you're a plants person, like near our office, or Afi for a long time has been talking about, and they've staged a couple of night markets.
Sorry, who?
Afi. Asian Americans for Equality, a big not-for-profit here in Chinatown, has been talking about Asian culture of a night market. And Last summer, they posed a kind of a problem that we wanted to respond to, and we had a couple of sessions with them and people about, could you create a new kind of street out of the bottom of Allen Street, which is ultra wide, and make something that could be both a street and a night market. So I thought, you know, it had the start of planning, but I thought it would be great to brainstorm with you guys about kind of how to kind of, speaking of the kind of gateway to Chinatown, that's sort of the gateway to the waterfront, and making a street into a room might be really great.
It'd be amazing. So we're going to turn on the room mic.
Okay.
And hopefully we should actually be able to hear everything back there or in the front pretty clearly.
Great.
But thanks for the half hour chat.
No problem.
And we'll grab you in a little bit again also once we talk about Night Mark a little bit.
Great.
Well, thanks, Larry.
Okay. Let's see how this works.
Great.
All right. So we wanted to grab Claire before she had to take off and get along together because it's all like a plus pool family. So Claire is who we're honoring at the gala on Wednesday. For anybody who wants to get tickets, pluspool.org/gala. And Alon is our newest board member. So, A, thank you for joining the project.
Sure.
And actually, I think this may be one of the first times we've really talked about Pluspool directly. I know you were at our last board meeting. But what I wanted to do is try to grab you guys, especially following the night market discussion we just had, because obviously I get very excited about initiating things, because I think as an architect, you're often like a pool project. As an architect, you're often asked, you're commissioned or you're hired as a service basically to design something, which as important as that is, I think there's always something about just being a person in the city, feeling like you have an agency to do something in the city. And not really sure I'm going with this, but I feel like you two are obviously a big part of that also move. And so maybe a really simplistic question is how or maybe even why you got involved with Pluspool in the first place. Start with you, Claire.
Oh, I want to hear Alan joining the board first, yeah. So I can end up go for it.
Well, for me, it was like some connections I had with people already involved and on the board, and the project really tapped into so many things that I talk about and care about all the time. It's probably two or three things. One is I'm from New York and was born and raised in New York, and see the city changing and really feel like New Yorkers are somehow lost in the evolution of this great city. And I'm one of these people who gets very emotional when they talk about New York, or, you know, I fly over the city, I tear up every single time. And so this project really kind of found a hidden beauty or virtue in the city that was inherent to the city, both environmentally and also from a community point of view. So that felt right. And then also, the sheer ingenuity of the project, you know, I try to involve myself in, you know, innovative technological things, and this was undeniable. And it was just, you know, this idea of let's see if we can do the impossible. I was like, that's cool. That's the right audience for me, you know.
A little closer.
Oh, sorry.
Thanks.
That's the reason I got involved.
I love the right? So I'm not a New Yorker, but I have to say that the city is amazing. And I also kind of tear up when I fly in at airports. And the question is why, you know? And I'm always asking that question myself. Why? What is it about New York that's different than other cities? And I think it's because, you know, I hate that word meritocracy, but it sort of applies to New York, as in the toughest ideas, the kind of an idea like filtering the water from the East River and giving everyone a chance to swim, not in a building, but out in the river. As audacious as it is, it's a kind of New York idea. And I feel like that's why people come to visit here. That's why they go to school here. That's why they, you know, may live in another city but move back, because they feel like New York is a place where everyone has a chance. And where tough ideas, okay, so it is not easy to do audacious ideas. But if you can, it's really true. If you can do it here, then other cities will want to do it there. Mm-hmm. And Joshua David's on the board, and I think the High Line is a good example of once we were able to pull it off in New York, then other cities kind of said, why can't I have my High Line? So I find, you know, the fact that Plus Pool as a collective, Plus Pool started by designers, by architects, Plus Pool started by people who just wanted to swim in the river, but they wanted science and technology to provide an answer for it. It seems so New York to me.
Right. It kind of sounds like a song. Where you know, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. This whole idea.
Oh, that song.
I mean, that song. Have you heard that song? But the idea that people come here with this kind of audacious dream to make it, and you know, it's so maybe it's inherent to Plus Pool. It's sort of a visitor to New York that wants to make it here.
So, like, what is it about New York that either allows people to do that, or is it actually that the people here are just of once you get kind of in New York, that's your mindset is like, I should be able to do something, or I just have this need to create something.
Yeah, I mean, so I look at it from a very personal place. You know, my parents are immigrants here, and they came. It wasn't a choice, really. Like, can I survive? It was really, they were escaping something almost, and it was dire, and it was, you know, we had to kind of find a way. And so that survival instinct, I think, is uniquely New York. It's very hard to thrive here. But yet, if you can, you really can achieve a certain level of success that you can't elsewhere. So I think that stark reality, and that applies to immigrants from Haiti, but it also applies to, you know, suburban kids from New Jersey who are just trying to make it. I don't know.
Do you, because I remember when I first moved here, and I'm sure this is like the same thing with a lot of kids when they move here, is you want to be part of New York. For sure, you want to be. You know, there's an energy there. You know, there's a lot of people doing amazing things. But the, I think especially with looking at you guys and actually a lot of the guests, there's always like a transformational moment where you're not no longer just kind of soaking it in and riding New York, but you're actually, oh wait, I can actually be a part of shaping New York. I can actually put something out there that wasn't there before. I can actually guide it, even in a tiny way or a very big way. Have you guys always thought that way about your work in terms of, oh, everything I put in New York is actually a way to shape New York? Or, like, for me, it's relatively new. New York was always a kind of gleaming, amazingly, but intimidating place to be, and it still is in a lot of ways. But that same thing of being comfortable enough to now feel like you're an active part of it, to shape it, is, I think, not something that I came here with.
I think that any part of New York, though, is interesting. Any part of it, from Soundview to Coney Island to the Rockaways. And I've been trying to figure out why is it so interesting? And why is it so interesting to people who have just moved here, you know, like 3 days ago, and people who grew up here? And some of it, you know, I kind of blame on our idea of city planning, in that there's a kind of heavy real estate thing, which is if you have permission to do something, you can do it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go back and ask permission. So it's like the as of right. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the as of right thing where in most other cities like London, Paris, you have to negotiate constantly the right to do something. And in New York, you only have to negotiate something if you really want to break the rules in terms of massing or whatever. But most places in New York are just there now, and it's already says what the parameters are, and it's just up to you to do something with it. And I feel like our streets, our subways are the great connectors, and they kind of, people roam around and go, what about that? And very few other cities solicit that, because they either, you have to drive everywhere, and that kind of gives you separation from other people. But because people are more connected, I think ideas flow more easily in New York. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's impossible to be disconnected in the city. You know, you just by virtue of being on the block, you're connected to other people, and new things happen and new potential happen. But I think there's something interesting that I have to call out, spending time with the two of you, which is amazing. I don't spend a lot of time with architects and designers all the time. But this instinct that I can change this world, this reality, that comes to you very naturally. Like, well, this can look very differently if you thought about it this way and that way. And as someone who that's not the vocation, and maybe someone who's from the city, I don't think that way. You know, I'm not walking down Allen Street thinking, well, this would be great. Why don't we just move this here and move that there? And again, it has something to do with vocation, but it also has something to do with the fact that I'm from here and I'm subconsciously resistant to changing the landscape, you know, and although I think it's a great idea and I want that.
But it could also go terribly wrong.
Yes, terribly.
There's plenty of examples, I think, of that, too.
Yeah.
People thinking they can change something, and then...
But maybe it's this kind of back tug and pull between don't change anything and change something that gives it the energy.
As opposed to being like a impulsively changing all the time.
Exactly.
Or not changing at all.
Right. Or like tearing down everything at once.
Right.
But also, I mean, a lot of it, in your work, it's... Even though it may not be architectural, obviously, but you're still adding to the energy of New York. You're adding to the substance of New York,
right?
Even if it's not a building.
No, I think that's true. But it is about the vision, right? So we all have sort of we're equipped with different ways to see the world, and I think this idea of changing the landscape is something that is not unique to New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's important to remember that. But it's also very exciting. The High Line's a great example of that. You know, we never thought that anyone would ever hang out. You know, people live there. People, bought drugs there and all sorts of things. But the idea of, like, recreationally enjoy the view from the High Line, which we all knew. We all knew those train tracks. We all knew.
Yeah.
But the idea that you could bring this new life to it was a type of vision that was kind of profound and wasn't... It didn't come... From a New Yorker's sort of perspective, it had to come from a visionary sort of perspective, I think.
But what I think is interesting about New York is it doesn't change that much. So whether, like, one of the biggest changes, biggest ideas we've had in a long time is simply moving the cars out by 5 feet away from the sidewalk and putting a bike lane there.
Yeah.
Okay, like, it didn't change much, but it kind of changed everything.
Yeah.
And even the High Line, it was already there. No one changed it that much.
Right,
okay,
right.
They put fact that New York is strong enough, and we do resist change, which actually makes it that you have to think pretty hard. And you have to be, the change has to be really good for anyone to want to bother to do it.
Well, when you put it that way, when you put it, the things that are always here that we might take for granted, that's a really interesting brief, right?
Yeah.
Like the High Line, not only architecturally or from an urban planning point of view, because we, there are streets and there are squares that we can find better uses of, but also just, their buildings and their people and their communities that kind of haven't met their potential.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you exerted the same sort of creative vision that you used to bring the High Line to life, like how could you activate parts of the city or bring some vitality to the city? And I like that brief, it takes my brain a lot of different directions, because I think about Chinatown and I think about the streets that we're talking about, but I also think about, there are parts of Queens, for example.
Oh, yeah.
That
I love that brief because I keep thinking, even little things like what if there was just a little bit more space for a couple more restaurants or what it could be really kind of small but really strategic moves that just like bring more potential from people who actually if they could they would just get use it. It's like because I think what's really magical is that kind of opportunity and people's own interests meeting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, actually we can do all more about, but we don't think we know. Like, we totally think we're powerless in that, right?
Well, the city does, right? Like, if you look at the way it's been carved, it's these pockets of communities, and we talk about the melting pot, but is there a space in New York that is truly reflective of that melting pot? Where we were talking about street markets or night markets. Is there a night market that really celebrates that variety? I kind of think the city is still relatively segregated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There isn't that kind of central point or place where you're like, oh, that's actually which is also sort of beautiful about it, but I can't think of that one moment in New York
or
where everything...
Or at least one for every borough.
There's definitely one for
I'm
every borough.
I'm almost like hoping that there are those spaces in different boroughs.
Yeah, I feel like there's definitely one of those in almost every kind of community pocket, mm-hmm. but I can't think of many where actually everybody, or at least a big percentage of types of New Yorkers really mix. Except you for know, maybe like
the subway,
yeah, I was gonna, or like
right.
the train station.
Yeah, that could be the answer, right? I mean, yeah. I was thinking Grand Central Station, and, mm-hmm. but my parents worked at the United Nations, and mm-hmm. you know, the United Nations is kind of an interesting place where you unapologetically bring where you're from, and but yet it becomes this other thing when you're around other people.
I wish mm-hmm. the UN was more public. Mm-hmm. Those of us that you know yes. don't have passes or parents don't work there, it's sort of like this big mystery yeah. where the nations of the world meet and you don't get yeah. to go.
Right.
Because it makes me think, like, couldn't we have our own United Nations yeah. that is more public?
Like the public
That's
UN.
That's a great idea. Let's do that.
All right, next time Claire's here, we have another workshop planned already.
Allah has to lead this one, for sure.
Well, I'll tell
our
you,
United Nations.
I send my kids to the United Nations school, the international school, and mm-hmm. they have a annual food market that they do. Or it's you bring your own homemade food
really?
And you share it with the community. And literally, it's like a little space of probably 300 stalls or so. And every country is represented there. It's probably the only place in the world where you can have homemade food from all over the world in one place. But to your point, it's far more public, far more approachable. You know, at the UN, you have politicians representing us that you may or may not support. Yeah. But at that lunch thing, it's like on a mac
oh
and cheese,
God, so good.
French fries. It's American. It's like nice experience. But then you really not far away, you have bibimbap and you have you know Turkish food and so on.
Is
so.
That lunch thing open to the public? Can I just
no.
show up and
no, but that's
see?
The
it's
point.
Not.
That's the point.
The problem.
Yeah. That's the point. I think that's yeah.
cool. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank
just
you.
Like quick.
Right on lunchtime.
Yeah,
right. On
time. Time to eat.
I love how we ended up at food.
Always.
Which is food radio.
Yeah. Right? Awesome. Thanks, Claire.
Thanks.